Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Brain Gains. Today we have a special guest on in the shape of Steph Blankart, who's in here to talk about the psychology of training. Talk about things like patterns of adherence, habit formation, why some people are successful in the gym and others aren't, and just generally to talk about the extra things we can do behind the scenes to maximise our training results. I'd like to welcome Steph Blankart. Steph, do you want to introduce yourself? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Thanks, Tom. Hi, everyone. My name's Steph. Who am I? I train with Tom, which is, I guess, how we've gotten to know one another. And it turns out that Tom and I like to bond on psychology and all the things psych research, which is always good fun. I studied psych at uni, and so I'm always pretty interested to think about how I can bring it into my life and how it impacts everyone else's lives as well. Just thinking really practically about how to make things better.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you. First, cab off the ranks. I think one thing which is obviously available when you talk about psychology and the psychology of training is how some people are really capable of sticking to training and being incredibly disciplined, but other people are less good at that and find it much harder to get going and stay in gear. Do you think that's something which is inherent, or do you think there are skills and there's a bit of plasticity around that?
I think there's plenty of plasticity around that, for sure, because I think there's definitely been studies where they think whether certain people are more adherent than others, and whether that comes down to personality types and certain factors. But it seems like there's no correlations there. And
okay.
Really, it's more down to so it's not necessarily whether you're so it's down to certain other factors. It can be things even down to whether you're optimistic, or whether you're or really just your attitude towards training, and whether you think that whether you've got the skills and resources to be able to do it more so. And so I think that's what tends to differentiate people more so than your personality types. Yeah. And things like that.
So rather than temperament, you're saying optimism and very much the accessibility of their goals is a big thing, or?
Yeah. And being able to design it so that you've got the resources, design your training so that then you've got the resources to be able to do it and be adherent.
Yeah. So it's the old SMART acronym. Yeah. The classic goal setting.
Yeah. Classic goal setting.
Yeah. Okay. That's very interesting. Yeah. So in terms of then optimism, do you think the exposure to training makes people realize their goals are more achievable then? How do you think we should go about getting people to start training?
Yeah, so if you want to, so they call it self-efficacy. So that's your belief, the belief in your own ability to perform a task in a situation.
Okay, yeah.
So say you've got a training session, you've got the program set up.
Yeah.
So when you look at it, do you think you're capable of doing it? The things that you can do to improve that, number one, is definitely performance in the first place, doing it right.
Yeah.
You're oh, hey, I can do that. So then, hey, maybe I can make it a bit harder the next week, or introduce something new, or whatever that is. And then there's also other things that you can do as well beyond just yourself. So seeing other people do it, and you're Tom can do it, and so therefore I can do it. That doesn't quite work here because you're a bit larger than I am, but that's fine.
Yeah, so then obviously creating a positive training environment.
Yeah, exactly.
Then if you were, say you're an individual training alone in their garage, what kind of things do you think you can put in place to make your training to make yourself more optimistic about your training with the goal of improving adherence then?
So, okay, think about your environment, right? So if you're training garage, number one, you're on your own.
Yeah.
That's what probably stands out to me is being the biggest thing. And so especially if you're someone who's quite sociable generally, you probably want some sort of social accountability going on there. So you might want to think about things bringing along a mate, bringing a mate into the garage, or even just chatting about mates or something, chatting with your mates or something about it. So that increases your adherence that way, because you can think about drawing in those elements.
Yeah, so some kind of buy-in to that process sounds really essential.
Yeah, so that's one thing you could do. Something else is you want to start off easy and achievable, right?
Yeah.
And then gradually increase it.
Yeah.
And you can probably do that, picking certain things, rather than going across every single exercise to try and make everything better, try and really pick a focus to improve, because then you can have that really focused improvement every time.
Okay, so do you
keep on exposing yourself to it.
Do you think there's much rationale in there being undulations in training difficulty then? So beyond just simply a sports science approach, do you think there's merit to having an easier intro week or periods of time where psychologically you feel you take stress off?
Yeah, I think definitely. Because, like, if when you think about, I don't know, it's probably jumping more to, like, creating a habit and things like that. But you kind of go through the stages of, like, well, at first you start off, like, not training at all and not really thinking about it. But then you bring those thoughts into mind. Then you kind of, like, equip yourself with more resources and things like that. So if you start off, like, easy at that point, build it. And then as you go on and once you're, like, maintaining, like, a particular pattern and, like, pattern of training and things like that, then you can probably challenge yourself way more. But, like, that initial phase is probably pretty important to keep, like, achieve.
To keep sufficiently, like, easy.
Sufficiently easy.
See, that's really interesting, just anecdotally, because I find a lot of people tend to be 100 or nothing in their training approach. Do you think potentially that obsession with going at a full intensity from the beginning actually handicaps people's capacity to form habits there?
If you don't have the resources, right? Because if someone's at 100% at the beginning, like, classically, think about it, if it's, like, New Year's and they're on some, like, new gym membership or something like that, and maybe they've got, like, sessions with a PT or something like that, then they're, like, pretty well equipped to then start off pretty hard. But then go later down the track and then they might have challenges there. But then if you're starting off a program, don't have too many, like, extra resources on board, then like, I think going at totally 100%, like, that's where it can potentially fail.
Okay.
Because you don't have the resources.
Yeah, okay. To what degree do you think those resources being available are linked with having people around you, though, as opposed to actual resources? Because I think your example with a personal trainer is a really interesting one.
Yeah.
Because I think, shameless plug for personal training, I think one of the main ways that the majority of personal training works is some kind of external accountability and by creating some kind of buy-in.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So do you mean as in
when you talk about the resources available to an individual, do you think a large capacity of the usefulness of those resources exists around the fact that there's buy-in both socially and financially to acquire them? Or do you think that's in and of the resources themselves?
Probably a bit of both, right?
Yeah.
Because I'll just jump to the buy-in one. Like, obviously if you are buying into something, then you feel like if you're not adhering, then you're just, like, losing out in terms of what you put in. So I think that definitely contributes. But then, I don't know, there is definitely, when you've got, like, effective actual resources. So there's, like, the physical part of the resources, but also, like, the mental side of it.
Okay.
And I think, you know, when you've got, think about even just, like, the thought of, like, having a personal trainer or someone socially around there, then, like, makes you feel supported, and then you go along, and then you've got, like, that's another resource.
So
even just that feeling of support in itself.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, do you think there's much of a difference between that, like, healthy, sustainable way of thinking and then, to totally put you on the spot, with, like, obsessive behavioural patterns? Or do you think there's a continuum on which they exist? Like, you have individuals who exercise and watch their diet obsessively.
Mm.
At what stage do you think that's then a product of their environment versus, like, a projection of an internal issue? Yeah.
Okay. But, like, is that... The thing is if you think about it in terms of, like, forming a habit, when you go through those stages, if you start off doing lots of things, like, really, like, recording, like, what you eat, things like that, then that's just going to continue on because you've kept on forming that, and it'll become less and less of, like, and like a burden to do because it'll just become easier over time if you practice.
Yeah, because you acquire those skills.
Yeah, exactly. You acquire the skills. Mm. So in that sense, it's like kind of behavioural.
Yeah, okay.
But then environmental, it'll probably be more like environmental at first, right? Because...
Yeah. Like, that's what makes you start?
That's what makes you start.
Yeah, okay. So I find that really interesting because I've seen evidence in the literature around people with things like orthorexia.
Yeah.
That the introduction of counting calories and education around calories actually improves their disordered patterns and brings them closer to normal, whereas most people would view that as being, in fact, actually a step towards that disordered kind of eating.
Like, because once you then step into that sort of area and you're thinking more, like, that kind of takes it away from the whole, like, adherence idea, right?
Yeah.
Because then you're thinking more, like, what does what does certain intervention do
yeah.
to then change
to
the
then
habits.
Reduce that
yeah to change their like other behaviors beyond just like training
no that makes sense yeah. interesting the again like on the total flip side of that yeah. we have like very damning data to suggest that 1 in 6 like weight loss interventions are actually meaningfully successful in the long term obviously this isn't actually an issue of like or entirely an issue of physiology because we know that the way to lose weight is create a caloric deficit we know that exercise regularly people often know the reasons why they should be doing that like why they should be doing the things and the things they should do but something obviously isn't happening behaviorally like you said so what kind of factors do you think drive our nation's health crisis one could say but also that really unsuccessful weight loss rate
I think it's a super interesting one. There's a number of reasons and it probably I think it's best probably viewed in terms of like when you think about dieting as like just generally as a concept because like if you create a huge like calorie deficit at first like that's just unsustainable right so if you've got really unsustainable patterns for a really long time people obviously aren't going to be able to keep them and then that then means that after a while like they might lose some weight but then put it back on right so like things like that and that's just like so it's just behaviorally unachievable but the other thing is like I guess you've got social norms are a massive one you know like what happens like it's obviously hard for someone when you go down to the pub with your mates and everyone else is like eating pizza and nachos and like I'm like and all the fries
and you're
like,
drinking like a glass like, of milk
exactly struggle right
very difficult
very difficult so like social norms and then I think it's really like accessibility and stuff as well because so that's where it's kind of jumping over to a different thing but if you think about it in terms of like even just economics so that's where like the things behind like sugar taxes and stuff come in right because if you like put a tax on sugar then it makes it like a higher end price less accessible blah 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 like soft drinks more like and so then people then can't afford them and are less likely to buy them
and if you do look at like a nice there's like quite a nice linear relationship between the price of food and it's like protein and micronutrients so that also stacks up really well there.
And so that's where those sorts of things come from
and
so it's about like in some ways like in that sort of way like I guess the like society stacked against you because it's pretty hard to like to get like tons of like high protein food like you know meat's pretty expensive etc etc like so I think that makes it difficult for people
often
and just to be able to then sustain it long term
Well, do you think potentially there's issues around the binary opposition of sort of eating when you're dieting and then eating every day too though do you think that contributes
For sure if you jump between different like basically different ways of doing things like from day to day that just makes it difficult for your like body to get into a bit of a groove like for you just behaviorally thinking you're like hold on I was doing this but and so like what do you I know to even like reduce it to like a like positive reinforcement like 1 minute you're fine and you're positive really reinforcing yourself for like eating burgers and then the next day you're like oh no I can't have that like it's just very mixed messages for you like for yourself right?
Okay for like that pattern of reinforcement I never thought of that
that's I don't know I just kind of like using that
because I think the and we can talk more about this but I think the demarcation of food into healthy and non-healthy is definitely causes more damage than it helps people. And what it means is it promotes that sort of binging mentality you've had one chocolate, your diet's ruined, as opposed from understanding that chocolate has like a caloric value there and fits in. What do you think about like for people out there who are having issues with that line or people who are finding they're tending to sort of binge and then restrict really heavily? What do you think an appropriate approach is there?
Like some of the thing on dividing food into like healthy, not healthy, has probably come about to do with like public health campaigns and like trying to sort of simplify information to tell people like foods to avoid, like
100%,
foods to eat, right? And so then like if that carries through, but the thing is like if that information is oversimplified, then you're gonna have problems. And then, but then like at the same time, if you don't give them information, give like the people the information that they're not going to be able to follow it either, right? And because like information is one of those massive resources in terms of adherence, right? Like think about it like in terms of like if you get like a prescription for antibiotics or something, if it doesn't have the right like dosage on the front of it, you're like, what do I do with this? Like how am I ever going to adhere to this properly? So, where were we? Is that, we're not a slide.
No, no, okay, going. Yeah, so you're saying
yeah.
There's issues around, like, enough information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, issues around having enough information. And so then, really, people probably need to, like, try and think about, like, educating themselves a bit more if they're looking to, like, diet and, like, restrict their calories and thinking more about, like, and really understanding that, you know, like, a chocolate is an item.
Yeah.
It has calories.
Yeah. Like that everything has
a value. Everything, yeah. Everything has a value, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And I think it's kind of understanding that and, like, what might be more, what might be less, like, calories and things like that. Like, I think it's about just understanding the basic principles behind that, right?
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Rather than
yeah.
just, like, good or bad, because also, like, good and bad, like, if you think about, like, the, like, if you're thinking, like, a traffic light system or something like that, you're just like, but what? Why is the traffic light red and bad? Like, is that because?
And then,
like,
there's always
is that sugar? Is that, like, what is it?
Yeah, and there's always more foods to remove too.
Yeah.
So, like, first you take out your simple carbs.
Yeah.
Then you've taken out complex carbohydrates, and before you know it, you're eating, like, chicken and broccoli.
I like broccoli.
So do I, actually. I think broccoli is
my favorite vegetable.
It is the most underrated vegetable on record. Actually, broccoli is definitely the most underrated vegetable.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, do you think the majority of people's weight loss and fitness problems stem out of lack of knowledge, though?
Problems. Define problems.
Well, think of the rationale for why people aren't in the shape they want to be, or as strong as they want to be. Do you think that generally comes out of lack of knowledge, though? Or do you think that's a deeper issue of action and adherence?
I think really it could come out of, like, lack of knowledge.
Okay,
for, like, a number of people.
Yeah.
Well, like, how do you know, like, really, in turn, like, how do you know, like, say if you've got a goal, like, you want to get, like, more muscle in your upper body, like, how do you know exactly, like, what exercises to do, like, what particular muscles there are, like, that sort of thing, like, how do you know, like, what isolation work to do, like, things like that, there's so much information involved, right?
Yeah.
Like, in terms of, like, volume, like, how much you need to do, like, there's just so many questions around that stuff, right?
Okay.
And so, like, that's a lot of information, but at the same time, I do think, like, you're also right in that there are probably people who know well and truly what to do, but...
Yeah, well, I think it's very common that perfect is the enemy of good.
Yeah.
And, like, a lot of people will wait until Monday when, like, today would be fine.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's interesting. I've never thought about it. I think one of the limitations of working as a personal trainer is that because you exist in that circle of the gym, you typically... your perception of what the people see and know is very distorted.
Yeah.
So, like, you deal in spheres where almost everyone counts their calories or almost everyone trains this kind of split or this way. It's very easy, I think, to assume knowledge, which you see daily, is actually generalized to the whole population.
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting.
No.
So then you mentioned a bit before how you're conditioning, like, a positive response or a negative response.
Oh, yeah.
To, like, eating a burger or eating healthily. Do you mind expanding a little bit for us about how, like, broad overview, how, like, conditioning works? Talk about Pavlov if you want.
yes.
But, yeah, talk about conditioning, how it works, and in what ways can we ourselves think about positively reinforcing our own training and trying to build habits along that line?
Okay. So, all right, where to start? Let's start with positive reinforcement, the greatest of all.
Yep, fantastic.
We love it.
Love
thanks for positively reinforcing by what I'm saying here. Positive reinforcement is basically where you're trying to increase the behavior and you do that through a positive action. So, for instance, like, you know, the classic is, like, you know, you tell your, like, your dog sits, and when the dog sits, you give it a treat, right?
Okay, yep.
So, and so then because of that, they're like, oh, well, if I sit again, then I'll get another treat, like, you know, so they keep on, so it's positive reinforcement that keeps on going along.
In what ways do you think you can apply positive reinforcement then into your training?
Into training. So then translating that into training, let's say, like, you can set up tons of rewards for yourself, really. Like,
Having some kind of structured
reward system, right? Yeah. Like, thinking about, and it would differ for every single person, like, depending on what you like.
Yeah.
Because not everyone's going to like the same.
For sure.
So for some people, it might be like, for some people, it might be like getting to watch another episode of whatever show you're watching, or like, or, I don't know, going out to lunch or something if you want to, or whatever.
How much do you think it matters if that reinforcement comes intrinsically or extrinsically? Also, like from you or from others around you?
From others around you.
Because I think, especially with weight loss, one of the problems is when people lose a noticeable amount of weight, they're very rapidly bombarded with positive reinforcement.
Mm.
And often it hasn't necessarily been a healthy or normal behavior, which is reinforced in the way they've dropped that weight. I know, especially for women.
Oh, really?
Because, like, I feel like society, there's more pressure on women to be slim than there is on blokes to be slim.
Yeah.
Like, being more muscular is generally, or more, appearing more athletic is more prized.
Yeah.
So, like, I'd be curious as to what you think about, like, the positive reinforcement of others potentially spurring unhealthy behavior there versus being actually useful.
Well, then it's, so then exactly, like, it's positively reinforcing a bad behavior.
Yeah.
So then really, then to counteract that, like, if it's not like a good behavior that you want to continue, then you need to think about ways to potentially even, like, punish it or, like, start another behavior, like a counter behavior to positively.
So then on the flip side, you mentioned punishing behavior. In what ways can you disincentivize yourself from doing things then? Like, obviously there's a flip side to that positive reinforcement. How can you reduce habits you may already have? Like, is it just practicing some mindfulness around it, or what do you think?
Ooh, interesting question. So you could, okay. So I think first, like, positive things that you can, I think positive things are quite hard to do in a training context, like to literally punish yourself positively, like to introduce something that punishes you. Like, that's just odd.
Doesn't make
sense.
Like,
you're imposing punishments on yourself, which like, who's going to do that really? Yeah. In a sense. So let's think more, it's more about taking other things away.
Okay, yeah.
So taking things away that then stop that bad behavior.
Yeah.
So then probably, like, in a training context, right? It's really down to, like, changing your training program, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's probably the
easiest
because you're taking out, like, the
thing which is causing the issue. That's very interesting. Do you think then on the front of reinforcement and positive behavior there, it's worth, like, obviously the classic one is, like, eating a little bit of food after your session.
Yeah.
What are some other ways we can start just even conceptualizing training as a more positive experience?
Like, well, yeah, exactly. Like, a positive experience. Well, that's how, like, they start. That's, like, one of the things when someone's trying to introduce a mindfulness practice, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the classic things is, like, you stop at the end and then you think about how you're feeling and you're feeling good, and that's the positive reinforcement in itself. So that's more intrinsic.
Yeah, okay.
So you, like, actually feeling good after a workout and things like that. So to improve that even more, you could probably think about what is the training that makes you, like, afterwards.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, are there particular exercises or things like that? I'd even wonder whether you could, like, structure the exercises in one of your sessions so that you end on, like, a great note rather than ending on a poor note. So why don't you even, like, finish on something that's, like, a little bit easy, like, a sufficient level of challenge but is still, like, quite achievable.
It's rewarding.
It's like then a reward at the end, and then you feel good, and then you're like, okay, cool, I'll go back again.
So do you think that links in then with there being a lot of utility in having performance-based goals, even when your main goal, say your main goal is to come in and to, like, it's like you've got 4 months till summer, you want to look better in summer.
Yeah.
Do you think then there's a lot of utility in having, like, performance outcomes which you can roughly correlate with that?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of, like, not just, like, an overall goal, but also then, like, sub-goals beneath it, right?
Okay.
Because you've got to break it down, like, saying you want a better body for someone, like, what is that? What does that look like? Like, just give me a sketch, you know? Like, a sketch, but in, like, dot points of, like, little goals. Like,
Do you think then there's relevance, especially with weight loss? There's a lot of discussion around the scales at the moment, like people throwing out the scales, people having issues with weighing themselves daily, weekly, monthly, whatever. And I think the important thing to think about scales is you don't actually have complete control over how the scales are.
No.
And they're outcome measure. Is that the correct term? Yeah. But that's not an action you do. You have to do actions in order to obtain that.
Yeah, in order to obtain that measure. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, so scales. Way to go with scales. Again, I think you can argue the information point on scales, right?
Yeah.
Because understanding like how the like how your weight fluctuates so much.
Oh,
like
massively.
So rapidly,
yeah.
Right? And so thinking about like how often you should really be weighing yourself,
yeah.
And keeping a log and tracking it, because just like if you have a standard goal, like on day one I'm like 70 kilos and on day 100 I want to be like 60 kilos.
Yeah.
Like that's just odd to only measure yourself twice.
Yeah, I agree.
You've got to go
through. Yeah, you got it. Well, how much do you think then exposure is useful for reducing anxiety around the scales?
Ooh.
Because
yeah.
So one thing I find a lot with clients is there was a stage where I was doing measurements once a month with people,
yeah.
Especially women, like typically a similar time of their cycle. And what I found is measuring once a month actually provoked quite a large amount of anxiety,
yeah.
Around that scale event.
Yeah.
Whereas then when you get people to weigh themselves once a week, what happens is those fluctuations, especially for women in their cycle, potentially confound.
Yeah.
Like what data you take.
Well, there's one way, like you can think about that as exposure, but also like is an information exercise. Like through
okay,
that,
yeah.
Like if they're measuring more frequently, they're understanding like that weight fluctuations happen,
yeah.
And like, maybe considering why that is, whether that's like a particular time in the cycle or like something else.
Yeah, they had heaps of
that,
salt
yeah,
the night before.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
Right?
Yes,
yeah, so
they retained a lot
more
water. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's also is like a little bit of like an information exercise as well as maybe like
okay.
There could be a bit, there, like
yeah.
Definitely could be a bit of exposure. And like I think there's like a bit of, there's certainly like an exposure argument to be had there. But yeah, I think there's also the information part.
Okay, that's very interesting. I never thought about the information side of that. But it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and because then, like, even if you don't necessarily understand why, but you've actually got the knowledge that, like, 2 weeks ago, like, I fluctuated up 2 kilos, and then the week before that, I was, like, down 2 kilos.
Yeah.
Like, you just sort of know that
yeah.
things happen.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. So the scales fluctuate, and like we said before, it's useful to have multiple metrics of determining
yeah.
success.
I love them.
So what kind of metrics for you personally do you like to track? What kind of things do you like to think about when you're training?
Ooh. Well, you know, I got to this stage in my training myself when I was like, I just don't understand where I am going with my program. I'm like, what? Where am I going? Like, I'm lifting things. I'm not sure, like, how much I'm going to be lifting eventually. I don't know. So then just even thinking like, oh, well, at the end of like this stage of your program, like you're aiming for like these weights in certain lifts.
Okay.
And things
yeah.
like that. So like that was super helpful being able to like see, and then you kind of got a goal there as well. Even though, and it's quite an achievable goal really, because it was thought out, you know, like you go up so many kilos each week and then you get to the end and you're like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
But I think being able to see that's good. And then you've got like a pretty good performance based measure there. Other things that you can set is like measures.
So sorry, on the on the performance based.
Oh yeah, point, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that there's merit to viewing those performance measures as your main outcome and taking that weight or that physique goal, and at least for part of the time making it like a side effect or a secondary impact?
Well, yeah. Depends. Like if you go back to SMART goals, right?
Classic.
So
yeah.
Classic.
Yeah.
Like specific is like, well, is your goal even specific in terms of, is it specific enough in terms of like particular weight loss or things
yeah.
like that? Like, what does that even mean? You know, you could lose, like you could like lose muscle and lose weight. Like, you know what I mean? Is that
yeah,
what
you
actually
could,
want? Right.
You could lose 3 kilos just by dehydrating.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, maybe it's not specific enough to just be like, let's lose some weight.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So then if you go more to like performance, then it is actually specific because you're like,
yeah.
I want to be able to do like 10 chin-ups or something. Right.
Yeah.
You're like,
yeah.
Cool.
Or five. Yeah.
Yeah, so you can just, so then that way that's very like specific, right? And then if you go down again, then you go to like measurable, you can easily measure whether you do 5 chin-ups, but then like measuring weight, like as we've said, each day different.
Yeah.
Maybe it's kind of difficult to measure weight sometimes.
Well, right? You've got to understand the limitations
yeah,
of
that
measure.
Yeah. Yeah.
100%.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then that's when you maybe probably bring in like other measures to back it up and consider things
yeah.
in context.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So
okay, the other thing which seems I hear a lot when I talk to people about is like a sense of shame around like whether they're embarrassed to be at the gym, they're embarrassed about their weight, and how that's like obviously not a particularly healthy reinforcement. What kind of advice and what kind of things would you, what kind of tactics would you put in place for someone who's feeling like nervous or worried about that first session? What kind of structures would you put in there?
Oh man, that's hard. Going to the gym for the first
your
time.
Your last structured question. This is a doozy.
Yeah, you're going to just hit me hard, aren't you? Okay. What do you do? Jeez. Like, you know, there is... Okay, so think about it in terms of... All right, let's think about this in terms of, like, whether someone's going to, like... whether someone's going to perform an actual behavior, right?
Yeah, okay.
So they've got intention to do that. They're thinking, oh yeah, cool, I want to start a program, I want to go to the gym. But then that's influenced by a number of things that you can then target. So think about, so number one, okay, let's think of like the like subjective norm. So think about like what do they think is normal? Like, do they think it's normal to go to the gym? Is it normal, like, within their own friend circle? Yeah. Like, you know, there are other people going. It's not whether they're going with them, but are they sort of, like, going and doing things in the first place?
And is part of that then conceptualizing themselves?
Then you're like, oh, well, then I'm normal. So, like, let's join the subjective norm, and then that helps the intention to then go. But then the other things you can have also is, like, the self-efficacy point.
Yeah.
So then that's the resources and like whether you believe that you can whether you can achieve that particular thing. So then it's really about like picking the right kind of session or the right kind of like gym. You know, you're not gonna like go out and do some like crazy super hard thing when you've never done anything. No, you haven't like trained in 5 years or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So I think that's something. And so then I think it's about being able to like tap into that. Like they're probably the main two, I'd say, right? Really is like the subjective norms.
Okay, yeah.
And that's where a lot of like health intervention things come in, right? Because they make it out that just make it seem that it's like quite, that it's like, that like the subjective norm is to like exercise or participate.
Yeah,
like,
it's not 100%. And I think the normalization of obesity is like a bigger topic.
Yeah.
But I think that's definitely negative in that way, isn't it? Because
Exactly. So then how can you think about tapping into like, so then it's really about like being able to tap into that like self-efficacy point, I think is like massive in terms of like, cause like the meta-analysis actually said that like the self-efficacy like point is quite big in the intention thing, especially for first time exercises.
Yeah. Okay.
Like people starting training for the first time.
And do you think that's a skill people have, like people develop that in separate domains of their life and then transfer that across? Like, I see a lot of people... It's interesting. When I train people, I think a lot of the time the people who are the most immediately successful when they start training are people who've been successful in other fields because they identify and they understand with adhering to a process to achieve an outcome.
Ah, okay. Yeah, then they've got a resource, right?
Yeah.
They understand, like, the process.
Yeah.
Like, they understand the process. They understand, like, even, you know, experience when you, like, have learned... like how to play the violin or something, you know that, you know, you had to like go through the original steps, you had to go through the hard practice where it didn't sound very good and it didn't feel very good to do, but like you kind of got there and you got better in the end. So like I think understanding that those processes can be like difficult.
And likewise, do you think those processes then transfer from the gym to everyday life?
I think it could. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's how you build skills and like it's not just domain specific. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's definitely, as you said, like transfer.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Steph. Do you have anything you want, anything more you want to say, anything more you want to talk about, questions to ask?
Oh, so many questions. Can I ask you a question?
Feel free.
If you were able to, like, I know that you asked me, like, a bunch of questions.
Yeah.
But if you were to be able to, like, if you say that you were able to, like, look at your clients and be able to like conduct like a bit of an experiment on them, what would it be? We know that you're a bit of a science nerd. Pretending that
that's
like
not
it's totally
already happening.
It is not happening. We all know that it is. But like what would it be? Like is there something that you do across like every single client that you've got? Like is there an umbrella thing?
Not really. No, I think like the thing which I'm increasingly interested in, like I mentioned earlier, is the psychological drivers of what actually makes people successful in the gym.
Yeah.
Because I'm at a stage where every adherent client I have improves more or less at the rate and in the manner I expect them to. Okay. So, like, the actual, like, if you come in and you're willing to do X, Y, and Z, they will get the intended result because you do these things and there's a process and there's, like, evidence and science suggesting this is how things work. But I think the only people I have who don't necessarily get the results they want are the people who don't do the things they do. And I think as a personal trainer, as someone who's, like, done, like, things which involve, like, habits and discipline and practice, it's really disingenuous just to say try harder or, like, do more work. But I genuinely do think, like, that behavioural aspect is the actual thing which determines if people get results. Because, like, people get results on substandard programs.
That's true.
People get results doing a whole array of wacky things, and it's because they've bought in and there's something in there which still works.
Well, also, yeah, they've bought in. And then also I think the other thing is that, like, you could not be totally adherent, but I feel like you could believe that you could, like, achieve, like, your goals and just kind of, like, hack it along the way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think a large part of the study I'd love to perform, it would be looking at what kind of external factors and previous experiences make people better at things.
Yeah.
Like, there's a really cool study in mice or rats, or in a rodent. Potato, potato. But no, where they looked at their propensity to run without reward.
Yeah.
And after several generations of selective breeding, they bred mice, which just hopped on the wheel and ran without any reward or prompting. But I do often wonder to what extent does, like, a genetic reason to drive and push yourself playing in the gym? Because, like, I know, like, I'm actually really lucky. I like all the people I work with, if you're listening. But no, I think some people, whether it's through past experience or inherently, have this capacity to just work incredibly hard, and other people don't. And I think that's, like, some people work really hard in the gym but find adhering outside of the gym quite difficult. Other people are really good at fixing their diet, fixing their lifestyle, and find turning up in the gym a bit harder. So I'm really curious as to what kind of factors influence success there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, so if anyone wants to be in my study, you probably already know who I am if you're listening to this. Actually, we now have a grand total of 20 listens ever. So thank you guys. Thank you for all the support. Thanks, Mum. So that's it. I think
awesome.
Psychological determinants of performance are very interesting.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Thanks, Tom.
Steph, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
No worries.
And we'll chat to you guys soon. Thanks for listening.